Welcome back to There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. Join us in this episode where I speak with Pete Seeger's biographer, David Dunaway. In our conversation, we discuss David's early connection to Pete Seeger and his music, and how he came to publish three editions of Pete's biography. We also talk about the archive of Pete Seeger material David has produced for the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, as well as Pete's involvement with Folkways Records, The Legacy of the Clearwater, and David's perceptions of the upcoming Bob Dylan biopic, A Complete Unknown. We conclude by discussing David's favorite Seeger records, in addition to what people should know about Pete Seeger now that we are a quarter of the way into the 21st century. Well, David, thank you so much for being available, number one, to chat about Pete Seeger today. I would love to begin by asking you just, I know a little bit about your background, but for the other listeners, maybe you could tell us just how you personally first became familiar with Pete Seeger and his music, and what was it that led you to being interested in writing his biography?
Okay, I was listening to Pete Seeger and the Weavers before I could walk, carried on somebody's shoulders to concerts and union halls where he often would sing. My mother and Pete Seeger actually shared a classroom at the downtown community school where my mother taught drama in the front and Pete taught music in the back. During the blacklisted era where that was about the only place he could teach. So I had a very early window into Pete Seeger, and as I grew up, Pete Seeger was everywhere, and he was the guy who wouldn't shut up during the McCarthy period. And I admired that a lot, and I would go to hear him every chance I got. I have a notation somewhere that in 1963 I heard him 23 times. So I guess you could say I was a follower, if not a fan, or maybe both. Then after college and graduate school, I was casting around for something to write after my slim volume of poetry, and I said, well, you know, if you're supposed to write about what you know, you might as well write about Pete Seeger. And I wrote him, and he was initially reluctant, telling me to write about Aunt Molly Jackson, a labor singer from the South in the 20s and 30s. And I said, well, you know, I think it's important that somebody who understands your background, where you came from, the world in which you have functioned for all these years, to write about you in hopes of creating a situation where somebody at a later time after you're gone could get a sense for you, your mission, and what it felt like to be in a Pete Seeger concert, which was a unique experience. And he wrote back finally, why don't you call it One of the Song Agitators? And I said, well, I thought that was oblique and people wouldn't know what the heck was going on. And he said a few simple rules for our collaboration, and I always followed them. And the book came out originally in 1981 in the fall and has had three successive revisions based on working with Pete and my desire to make the book as readable as possible with a full documentation. And so that's where we stand now, all these years later. And I produced a radio documentary series, 3 1-hour documentaries available from me directly on CDs and a discography of his work, which I would say 96% complete. I prepared a collection under my name, David Dunaway, for the Library of Congress with the 14 interviews I did with him. And then I did another book called Singing Out, an Oral History of America's Folk Music Revivals for Oxford. And that has a lot of Pete and his colleagues discussing the importance and merger of politics and music.
Now, I'm curious, for that first edition of the book that came out in 81, were you in contact with Pete up until that time because of that connection you had at school? Or, you know, had you been far apart and then you got back in touch with him again? How did that approach sort of happen?
Well, He meets and met a lot of people, and I don't think he remembered me. He remembered my mother because he used to teach with her, and we also had in common a very important figure in his life, in Toshi's life, his wife Toshi's life, and in mine, and that was an educator and camp director called Norman Studer. Norman started the downtown community school where Pete was hired. He was also the first person to have Pete sing at a summer camp back when Pete Seeger was hitchhiking around the Catskills, painting pictures in exchange for the chance to sleep in someone's barn. And he became a mentor to Toshi, to Pete, and to me. And Norman wrote a letter attesting to my seriousness about this. And I think that, combined with my mother's familiarity, did the trick.
And we're speaking, of course, of Camp Woodland, correct?
Yes, that's correct. As a matter of fact, there's a scene in my book, How Can I Keep From Singing, the Ballad of Pete Seeger, where Pete came to sing at Camp Woodland in Phoenicia, New York, weeks before his appearance before the House Committee on Un-American Activities. And I have a recording of that, so I know what happened there. I don't identify myself in the book, but that chapter is from that very concert.
And so you were talking about how Pete was sort of reluctant to have the book done and to do all these interviews and participate and stuff, but he was willing to go through with it. And then in the other editions that have come out, he was further involved at that point in the 2008 edition. You went back to work with him a little bit more on it.
Yeah, he wrote me a letter, Dave. He's the only guy that gets to call me Dave. You're a good writer. Come talk to me some more, and we'll go over the book. And I did that, and he subsequently wrote a preface for it. And so I have to hear mention that their biographers like myself distinguish between authorized and unauthorized editions of work. An authorized biography means that the subject that you're writing about and his family and protectors and managers read the text and suggest or demand changes. This was an unauthorized biography. He never saw the text, nor did Harold Leventhal, his manager, until the book came out. Subsequently, of course, he had copies of the book, and each edition, I sent him a copy, and he would periodically comment about this. There is in the Library of Congress, as a matter of fact, a copy of the manuscript with Pete and Toshi's comments about it, in case anyone is curious to see what he said. I corrected the book after their comments. Some of them were quite insignificant, like the fact that a quote that I attributed to his brother's first wife came from his second wife. It was the right words, but the wrong speaker. And some of them were, I think, thoughtful and challenging. One of the main comments that he made is that, contrary to what most people would expect, the period when he was denied access to American audiences on television, on radio, and in most performing venues, I thought that was necessarily a strain, and he said, no, well, yes, it was a strain, but I felt like a soldier going into battle. A soldier needs to go into battle, and I needed that. So for me, these years were good years, because it showed that I had, Seeger said, an influence on people and on events.
That's one thing I'm curious about. I mean, Pete was interviewed multiple times and on different occasions said that was asked, like, what is the most important era or period of your life musically? And he did a lot in the 60s, but he said that that period of, you know, the mid-late 50s into the early 60s, that that was the time that he was able to connect with the audiences that he always wanted to connect with. And, you know, he had established himself and his musicianship by the time he was in his 30s, you know, he was really a top musician. And then the Blacklist forces him to do these other things. And I mean, would you agree with that? Would you say that that period, for Pete anyway, did he see that as the most important period? And is there any other period that equals that?
Well, like most musicians, he continued to evolve his style and his focus. I think some of the best recordings Pete Seeger made were those from the late 1940s. I just played on the radio recently on our public radio station, KUNM Albuquerque, where I am a feature, pieces from the Goofing Off Suite. These are very powerful, alternately, you know, his rendition of Bach and Beethoven, and some very fine guitar work. You know, Pete Seeger, during his early 20s, during the days when he lived in the Almanac House and performed with the Almanac Singers, he was listening, and Woody was living upstairs in the house in the attic and writing Bound for Glory in those days. And Pete was listening very hard to traditional music. And it's important to remember how he came by that music. Starting in 1936, his father, the man who taught the first course, Charles L. Lewis Seeger, the man who taught the first course in folk music at an American university, was married to Ruth Crawford Seeger. Ruth Crawford Seeger, during the 40s and 50s, served as a transcriber, a musical transcriber for the Library of Congress's Archive of Folk Song. they had the rare 78s. They had them right there, and Pete was listening to them. And by the way, Mike Seeger was listening to them, and Peggy Seeger was listening to them. And they all made an album together, not Pete, but Charles and his singing family, the Singing Seegers, which is kind of hard to find now. It's a 10-inch Folkways. But it's beautiful stuff, and you can hear Peggy and her early banjo playing and many other great things in that first recording. So Bess Lomax Hawes, Alan Lomax's sister and the daughter of the great John Lomax, folk song collector, once told me that, you know, except when he was sleeping, Pete Seeger would be out there on the steps in Greenwich Village playing his banjo constantly, 10, 12 hours a day. And I guess that's how you learn to play an instrument. So as far as the periods of his music, well, you have to distinguish his performance of traditional songs, almost like him being a folk singer, a term he had very mixed feelings about, because his father quite carefully defined who a folk singer was and wasn't in his essay, The Folkness of the Folk. That period of basically folk revival music that he recorded in the 40s and 50s differed from his own songwriting. Everything from putting a tune to Ecclesiastes in Turn, 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 to his political ballads like Waist Deep in the Big Muddy, and many, many, many others. Pete Seeger, a lot of people don't realize, is one of America's most recorded musicians, up there with Duke Ellington, for example. I lost count in my discography of how many albums he did, but I would say it's over 150, and there are not many people that could produce that.
No, and the majority of those are Folkways records. And Pete was, of course, in 1961, John Hammond steps in and is able to get him signed to Columbia. And you talk about in the book how Pete sort of felt slighted eventually by this, and that it was just a performative thing. It was Columbia saying, we've got Seeger, so we've got the folk thing covered. And it allows Dylan to maybe get on Columbia and sets a precedent. But I mean, which is more important? Is Folkways more important for folk music, or was Columbia more important? And what role did each of these things play for folk music, for the revival, and for the whole movement?
Well, there's no question between the two. Folkways Records was established by Moses Ash to represent world folk traditions. And they did a terrific job of that, and not just American folk music. Recently, I played on my radio program, Folk Roots, on KUNM Albuquerque, a recording of Palestinian folk songs. Moses Ash recorded music from every dimension. He didn't always pay his musicians. But as Bess Hawes said, he was always good for a $5 bill and lunch. And maybe that was what was needed. Some musicians got a little upset by his cavalier approach to copyright and recording and everything else. But Folkways, which later became Smithsonian Folkways, was the foundation of American folk music recording. There are definitely other people who were making recordings which emerged on other labels like the Prestige Folklore and many others, including Columbia. But there comes this point, and you put it at 1961, where folk music became a commercial musical format. And Pete Seeger could not be neglected in that process, because he taught the folk songs to the people who became successful performers. In one concert in Palo Alto, he had Dave Gard of the Kingston Trio and Joan Baez talk about Johnny Appleseed. That was a moment, and from their careers afterwards, those two shifted an understanding of performing American folk music.
Did you ever encounter an inclination as to if Pete Seeger had a favorite musician or two? Maybe it's hard to narrow down, but who were Pete's favorite musicians?
Oh, I don't know if I could do that. He learned from so many. It brings to mind that old story about Woody Guthrie. Jack Elliott was performing across town when Woody, before he went into the hospital, was living out near Coney Island. And somebody ran in and said, "Hey, I just saw this guy across town, and he's performing all your songs, every one of them, just like you do." And Woody is reported to have said, "Well, that's nothing. He just steals from me. I steal from everybody." And although steal isn't exactly the right word, I think Pete Seeger learned from so many musicians who were so dear to him that it would really be hard to choose one or two. You know, back in the early 40s, when he was in his early 20s, he was listening to the Coon Creek Girls. He was listening to Uncle Dave Macon. He was developing banjo styles both by visiting and traveling through the South and by any recording he could lay his hands on. And Alan Lomax ended up providing a lot of them. There's so many others who were there. I just wouldn't want to make a choice.
I mean, he spoke often that his most important education was Woody Guthrie, and he spent so much time conveying Woody's music and conveying Leadbelly's music to everybody. And in his book, you know, The Incomplete Folk Singer, he talks about they were the best at combining the old with the new. And I've always gotten the impression that while he had many influences, like these two guys, when Pete was young, really made an impression on him that really stuck with him.
Oh, profoundly so, accurately so. But remember, neither of them played the banjo. His core repertoire was Southern Uplands banjo music, and that really was quite important for him. That's how he got his chops. Afterwards, yes, of course, he presented Led and Woody to the world, just as he presented Bob Dylan to the world. Very important. But Pete Seeger influenced an entire generation, or maybe we can say generations, of folk-oriented musicians. His influence on American folk music is unparalleled. And he learned from so many people at different times. He learned different kinds of things. He was a dedicated songwriter and thought a great deal about it. In the Library of Congress, you still can find some of his notebooks where he always carried a notebook in his back pocket and a pen or a pencil. And he would jot down musical phrases. He would jot down sets of words. It's very revealing to go through those, as I did over the 5.5 years that I initially spent writing my biography of Pete Seeger. That's where you can see his active imagination in play.
What period of time or what years were those notebooks from? Was it a range of years? Was it a particular period?
Oh, they started about 16 before he goes off to college. And then they're really adolescent fantasies and rhymes and ditties. And then later on, they get more and more self-conscious as he grows up and as he begins to really learn the banjo when he is 17 and through college when he decided that he wanted to be a journalist, but they did not offer journalism at Harvard. And when he began busking in the streets of New York, studying art at the same time, one of his art teachers famously commented to him, "Well, I haven't heard your banjo playing, but I would say, looking over your pictures, you should go with the banjo." And he did.
And, you know, during, I think, 1963, Pete takes off and his family, and they do their trip around the world. He does, I don't know how many countries, a dozen or so countries in a year and a half or something like that. And, you know, that experience of he's distributing songs or making songs more accessible to not just an American population, but a global population. At the same time, he's picking up other songs along the way that he still hasn't heard before. He's hearing for the first time. And he's taking those songs back to the United States and or to the West, we should say, and performing them when he returns. So I'm curious your perceptions of that world trip or world tour, if we could even call it that. And how important was that for Pete's musical work throughout the rest of the 60s?
Well, first of all, let us credit Toshi Ota, who organized that tour, who photographed it. Again, her photographs and her film is in the Library of Congress at the American Folklife Center with my materials. And they are very important and very revealing. Pete was always learning songs everywhere he went. One example might be the song Guantanamera, which I played a small role in at Camp Woodland, where he would go every year to do at least one concert for the campers. At the end of one of those concerts, I think it might have been in 1963, we said, "Hey, we got this guy here who's got this great song. You want to hear it?" And I was recording the concert. And so up came my camp counselor, Hector Angulo, who was a Cuban visiting the United States, and he sang this song, Guantanamera. And afterwards, Pete took me aside and said, "Hey, would you mind sending me a copy of that recording? I would like to transcribe that and put it into Sing Out." Well, Sing Out was a small folk song magazine, probably reaching at its height 25,000 subscribers, but Guantanamera traveled all the way around the world. And the version that he performed with the Weavers, which is one of my favorite ones because it's so beautifully set by the talented Freddie Hellerman, who was a member of the Weavers, is a beautiful one and one that I would recommend people to hear. So everywhere he went, people were teaching him songs and he was teaching them songs, and that's just the nature of his life. He started by learning Southern folk songs, which he performed on the banjo. He learned the banjo before he learned the guitar. Later on, of course, he became very talented, particularly in the 12-string guitar. And he played about at least a dozen instruments. He played the mandolin, he played the khalil, a small flute. He played other kinds of flutes. He played the penny whistle. He just went on and on because he had a musical soul.
During the 60s, you know, Pete seemed to be everywhere at the same time. Was there ever a time in the 60s when he wasn't traveling? I mean, how long was a stretch that Pete would spend at home in Beacon? The way I view it is that, you know, in many ways, he stretched himself thin during that period of time. And one could argue he didn't really slow down till, you know, 72, 73, 74. What do you think about that commitment and those decisions he made?
Well, first of all, I want to bring to the attention of anyone who is interested in learning more about Seeger's performances and career, although he hated that word and said he never had a career. I'm not sure one can accept that comment. I created a daily index of where Pete Seeger sang from, well, of significant events in his life, from the time he was born through the 70s, and even made additions into the 80s and 90s. And it sits at the American Folklife Center in a 3x5 cards, probably 1,000 of them, with specific dates as to where he sang and the source for that mention. I have tried over 30 years to build a collection at the Library of Congress about Pete Seeger and his community of those involved in the folk music revival, the material which I mined for Singing Out. And that's there for anyone that really wants to track down specific moments. I was getting too many queries from all over about, did he sing? I think he sang in September 7th, 1967 at this place. And I had a resource to answer them, but I'm an author and a professor, and I have a number of other responsibilities, and I just had to turn that over to the Library of Congress, American Folklife Center. But it's there. And I suppose you'd have to go there, because who's going to digitize 1,000 3x5 cards?
I imagine you're familiar with this, but I was curious if you knew that documentary, A Song and a Stone, from 1971, and what you thought of that thing.
Pete hated it. It was uncritical. It was a flowers in your hair celebration of Pete Seeger, which I think was largely uninformed and uninformative, both. There have been two subsequent films about Seeger, and they're both much better. Jim Brown's is the most comprehensive, but then later on some people at Wesleyan University decided to do a commemorative film about Seeger. And that has many interesting points. Jim Brown's, though, is the one. And among the other interviews that I deposit the Library of Congress is one with Jim Brown, talking about how he became involved in that through Lee Hayes, Pete Seeger's longtime companion and co-singer and co-author, songwriter. There you'll find some useful information. There was also a film put together by the Weavers' manager, Harold Leventhal, Wasn't That a Time? I think that is a celebration as well, but some of the facts aren't right, and they dodged all political issues that were crucial to understanding Seeger's career and the kind of principled resistance that I feel he represented. It was meant to be uncontroversial, but how you make Pete Seeger and the Weavers uncontroversial, I don't know.
I mean, Pete went on the Dick Cavett Show, February 1972, and was interviewed about A Song and a Stone. And, it's, you know, just sort of spoke about it in a descriptive way. I don't think he gives an endorsement of it for or against, but he doesn't say anything negative about the documentary on television. I don't know if that was intentional or not.
Pete Seeger took the very New England approach that we should not criticize things, products, people, in front or behind their back. So I'm not saying he wasn't critical. He was indeed very critical, but he did not like to make public statements about it. He certainly told me his thoughts, and they're there in the 14 interviews which I've deposited at the archive. Well, what was the Archive of American Folk Song and is now the American Folklife Center. And those interviews, by the way, are digitized and available under something called the David Dunaway Collection.
I think, and this is again just one of my impressions, but Pete, I think, was very proud of the Clearwater and what it became over time and what it turned into. And I think he knew that this was something that he would create that would outlast him, because it was an organization and it was an involvement of many community people, and it just had longevity, and as the music does too, but because it was participatory, because people could get involved in a hands-on way. How did Pete really feel about the Clearwater towards the end of his life?
Well, he always was an enormous supporter, but let's be clear, this was not Pete Seeger's yacht. It came about because, well, I tell the story in my biography of Pete Seeger, the Ballad of Pete Seeger, because he liked to sail, and he had his own little sailboat, and he was upset, even horrified, by the condition of the Hudson River up to the mid-late 1960s. And so he got together a group of people, Toshi always doing the organizing for Pete's bright ideas, bringing people together, calling them, writing them, making sure everything happened. There wouldn't have been a Pete Seeger without a Toshi Ota. And she was fundamental in the founding of the Clearwater movement. Pete always loved to be out on the water on that boat. He would have been there much more if he didn't have what he felt were serious responsibilities to help raise funds for various kinds of groups. And he did that. It's not so widely known that basically from the 1980s on, Pete Seeger refused to be compensated for his performances. He said, "I didn't want to give the government the taxes to use on defense." So he performed free. He asked to have his expenses covered, and those were modest. He would take the subway, he would take the bus, no limousines for Pete Seeger. And this is one of the fundamental I guess it's a contradiction in Seeger's life. He became a very famous and a fairly wealthy individual, but he always drove his little Volkswagen Bug. He resisted living luxuriously. He had that thrust upon him in his career with the Weavers, who were, after all, had four platinum million-selling singles in the early 1950s, but he really felt he had to live the life that he represented, and he did. One time he said to me, "You know, there are moments when I think that I might have had a stage name, Uncle Zeke or something, and then I could have been Uncle Zeke on the stage and lived my own life without the invasions of privacy for him and his family." I don't think he could have done that, because he operated in a Puritan New England tradition where, you know, you preach what you live and you live what you preach.
And it's that same kind of attitude that he had, I think, that when the Hootenanny controversy occurred in, was it 62? You talk about in the book how that whole thing disgusted him, and that this was an opportunity to share folk music. But then, of course, people still don't want him. He doesn't get back on TV until the fall of 67. But he encouraged other people to go do it. Pete had no judgments about other people making a living or, you know, working if they thought of themselves as having a career and participating in something like that. Even if he didn't feel like the music that Hootenanny chose was fantastic, he was glad that younger people were still going to do it.
Yes, but he thought the music was ersatz and phony. And if you watch one of those Hootenanny programs, there are all these clean-cut American teenagers dancing around and waving their hands. And it was a bowdlerization of folk music, and he knew the difference between a folk song and a folk song that was too prettied up and streamlined. And I think it would have been challenging for them to get in their format the kind of honest, direct speech and performance that Pete Seeger had. He was just too honest for them and too real. And there were a lot of issues. Judy Collins is the person that often comes up as an example. And yes, there was a meeting at Harold Leventhal's office with all of Harold's folk singing clients getting together, and Pete said, go ahead. And many did and many didn't, including Bob Dylan and Joan Baez, which were the trophy musicians that they would have wanted to put on Hootenanny. There was even a short-lived Hootenanny magazine. I think there were only three or four issues. I have them somewhere in my archives. And it was phony all the way down. It was a commercial undertaking which was not based on any understanding of what folk music is, what folk music was, what folk music would become. It was, here's something we can cash in on, and we're going to cash in on it.
Speaking of the more popular representations of the time, as you're probably aware, there's going to be some sort of major, who knows how big it'll be, but a big film that's going to come out next winter about Bob Dylan, and this movie, A Complete Unknown, about Dylan's early life in New York and then leading up to the Newport Festival in 65. Pete Seeger is his character is, you know, definitely acknowledged in this film. We're not sure to what extent or what it's going to look like, but can we expect anything positive about how Pete Seeger might get represented in this upcoming film, or is that not something that we should look forward to?
Well, I don't know any more than you do about the film itself. Nobody has contacted me to ask about it. I think they'll probably just scoop up my book and use that. Pete Seeger was represented previously on a film, but living people have to give permission to be included in films. And so Bob Dylan has obviously given his permission, and I don't know what pound of flesh he obtained for that. But in the film Bound for Glory, as I wrote for a magazine called Mother Jones when it first came out, they had a composite character that was clearly Pete Seeger, and they did not do a good job with that character. He was a cheerleader rather than a thoughtful individual who was committed. I think they'll do a better job now that there is a biography and other sources on Pete Seeger's life in creating a Pete Seeger character. Having said that, this is a feature film designed for theatrical distribution. It will be a bit sensational. I'm not looking forward to its portrayal of the 1965 Newport Folk Festival concert, where there was quite a to-do about Dylan's performance. And Seeger always said that he didn't mind the way that Dylan was singing, but the amps were turned up so much that you couldn't hear his words. And for Pete Seeger, you had to hear Bob Dylan's words. And I don't know this business. There is Elijah Wald wrote a whole book on that one incident and contacted me in the process. I don't know how accurate it'll be. I think it'll be sensationalized. I have a recording of that concert, and you can hear the fans booing Bob Dylan. Some people were applauding, many were booing, because there was a symbolic interaction that hasn't been fully understood. Bob Dylan was not the first person to go electric at Newport. Always, the old blues singers were allowed to bring along an amplifier and play blues tunes amplified. People have overlooked that. What Dylan was trying to do was Well, the French expression is épater la bourgeoisie, provoke the bourgeoisie, and that's what he accomplished. And the music is not as good as his music, not with the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, but with the group Levin and the Hawks, which became the band and performed behind him. So there are many different versions of what happened at Newport in 1965. It'll be curious to see which one they chose. And Pete talks about it at some length in the interviews and in my book, How Can I Keep From Singing?
I'm curious if you personally, David, have a favorite Seeger record and what that might be and why.
Oh, wow. You know, among 150. I think I have to answer that in the context of different generations and different moments in his life. As a biographer, I'm deeply interested in all the periods of his life. I love the Goofing Off Suite. I love Nonesuch. I love Indian Summer, which is a soundtrack that he and his brother Mike put together about a story of a dam in the Catskills and the communities that it displaced. You know, for expressing his sheer revulsion at the way the United States was in the late 60s, you have his song Letter to Eve, for example, which is a dark period. His recordings about the Clearwater are exactly the opposite, enormously optimistic. God Bless the Grass is one of the great early environmental music albums. I love that one. You have to understand that Pete Seeger's recordings, the bulk of them, were on folkways, and they weren't exactly what we would call albums. If he was in Midtown Manhattan, he would call Moses and Moash and say, "Hey, Mo, I got a few songs I want to sing." And he would walk up, and Mo had a room with one mic and a stool on which he could sit. And he would sit there and he'd play the songs maybe a few times, but a lot of them are one-track wonders. And then they would come out as Mo decided to produce them rather than as Seeger was thinking of them as an album. There were definitely albums, Songs of the Spanish Civil War, again, Nonesuch, and Indian Summer, and Goofing Off Suite, which were conceived of as albums. But the vast majority of his recordings were simply compilations of performances in Mo's little studio. So it becomes hard to distinguish between them in some ways, particularly the recordings in the 1950s, of which there were so many. So it's really hard to choose them. As in his later recordings, I think he was more conscious of what an album was. I'll tell you one album I'm really fond of. It's a recording, it was made in Greenwich Village, called The Bitter and the Sweet. That's a tremendous one, and it's on Columbia. And another in 1957 that he recorded with Sonny Terry, Pete and Sonny at Carnegie Hall, where the version of The Bells of Rimini is so dramatic, at the end you can hear the audience letting their breath out, an enormous sigh, because the musical tension which he had created in his performance was breathtaking.
And so that style of showing up and Moash would record and then shelve something for a while, I get the impression, even though there were five albums worth of material of like American favorite ballads, they came out successively over a period of like 5 or 6 years. And I think volume 5 was released in 62. So that must have been Moash playing around with, here's all these traditional songs and let's see what goes together and we'll get them out eventually. I mean, that was the philosophy behind a big collection like that.
As one of the great historians of the folk song revival, Dick Royce, once pointed out to me, American favorite ballads were not favorite and they weren't ballads. It was just a way of reissuing earlier recorded material in no particular order or concept.
So, I mean, David, we're nearly a quarter of the way through the 21st century, and Pete's been gone for 10 years. But I'm curious if there's something that you think listeners to this podcast should know about Pete Seeger's music and politics today. I mean, what's the thing that we should take away from Pete Seeger now?
Big question. I'll try and go at it a number of different ways. Well, first of all, when people talk about the folk song revival, they really need to be talking about the three folk song revivals. The revival that took place in Washington, D.C. in the 30s and up to the early 40s, centered around the Lomax family and the Seeger family, who lived not far from each other. And Pete was in those days, and his stepmother as well, working at the Archive of American Folk Song at the library. The second one we know, starting in the late 1940s, early 1950s, and running through till the early 1970s, the folk boom, the great folk scare. There are many different ways that people referred to it. Many of the traditionalists felt that the violence done to many traditional American songs was unfortunate. Then, in our own time, there is what Rolling Stone called the YouTube folk revival, where people just sit around in their living rooms and record themselves singing, and it inspires others to do exactly the same. And it grows and it grows and it grows and it grows until YouTube has thousands of these recordings that are homemade amateur recordings. You know, Pete has a few messages that run through his career. Make your own culture, make your own music, respect the traditions of musicians who came before, and not just musicians, singers, and singing traditions and folklore. Learn about them, respect them, and keep learning more. In a political sense, Pete Seeger was a Democrat, small d, a communist, small c. He believed in the sharing of resources, the sharing of culture, the importance of being informed about the world around you and becoming a global citizen. And as part of that global citizen, taking responsibility for the trends that are negative in our culture and our time. And I don't have to spell those out for you or for any listener there. It's if you're well informed as to what's going on, you know who is asking the oil and gas industry for $1 billion to be elected president. You know all of the potentially life-changing ways in which humanity has made some mistakes even as it built itself. Pete Seeger really wondered, when I would talk to him in the 70s and 80s, if there would be large human life 50 years from then. Well, we're still here 50 years later, but the planet is suffering mightily. And I think for him there was a unitary understanding of the need to take care of your neighbor, the need to take care of the traditions that inspired and informed us in an earlier era, and the need to become involved in political change and to make your voice heard for the causes you believe in. He always was available to do good works, and whether it happened in an elementary school or whether it happened on television, or whether it happened with Martin Luther King at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. He was equally comfortable in all those environments because he had a kind of unified life and theory of work, which was we all serve.
Recently, David, a couple months ago, I was part of in Western Massachusetts, where I live, kind of a concert of Pete Seeger songs. I don't know if we would call it a tribute concert or not. The title of it was Pete Fest, which is a name I didn't choose. But this event, we were talking, those of us who were going to perform, about what types of songs we wanted to do and what the structure of it was going to look like, and you know, what songs, you know, what focus of the songs and how much freedom do we have in choosing them in such a contentious time? And the question came up of what would Pete say today about the political situation? And I guess there's no real way of knowing the answer to that question. But we are in a state where it seems to me anyway, the problems that Pete talked about and sang about for so long, many of those things society came around on, many of those things we've regressed back into something else. And I just get the impression that Pete would be sad to see the state that the country or the world has descended into, but he would still find a way to be hopeful in some capacity. Do you have any sense of how Pete might look at the world? And maybe that's too big a question, I just wanted to ask you.
I was driving Pete around one time in the Bay Area, where I lived for many years and worked at KPFA, the first of the Pacifica stations, radio that is. And he just turned to me one time and said, "You know, David, it's all about inspiring hope, because that's the first stage in getting humans to look at their lives and make changes. Without hope, there can be no revolutionary change. People have to hope at the beginning, and that's part of my job." I think he would still find sources of hope, but some people have misread Pete Seeger and think of him as a Pollyanna who was not conscious of the serious barriers to fulfilling the hopes that he tried to raise. He was a very smart, very well-read individual, and he knew what was going on in the world, and he was dedicated to doing whatever he and Toshi could possibly think up in terms of how they could serve. It's worth remembering that one of the groups that he was most dedicated to and sent regular contributions to is the Middle East Children's Alliance, where he brought Palestinian and other groups together that the organization was doing this and he was supporting it very much. In later years, actually, in the last few years of his life, he kind of got tripped up or tricked because people asked him to make a statement about Israel, and some supported it and others did not. And he felt like he had gotten himself into a place where he was uncomfortable because he didn't fundamentally see himself as a political advisor, as a policy person, although he followed policy. His one worldism was a belief that extended naturally out from his sense that everybody has a place in the sun, and we have to get out of the way of the people who are enshadowed, colonized, oppressed, and everything else that prevents them from having a voice. I think having a voice in its literal and metaphoric way was perhaps his most basic message.
All right, David, we'll conclude it here. We're about an hour. Thank you so much for being a part of the podcast. Appreciate it.
It's my great pleasure. I have some worries that that people are forgetting Pete Seeger, what he stood for, and his contributions to American music and to American consciousness. And that's why I've spent so many years trying to build an archive, trying to document him on radio, a 3-hour radio documentary takes years to produce and fundraise, but it's available from me and people can look me up and find out how to be in touch. And if they're interested to listen to 3 hours of Pete Seeger's music and interviews and sources, why, they can find this. And I hope it helps them understand in an oral way what Pete Seeger was trying to do. I don't want to let him pass. I have to recognize that we all pass, but we all leave some kind of a legacy in the people around us, in the things we've accomplished, in the things we've tried to accomplish, and I don't want the enormous contribution that Pete Seeger has made to the world at large to fade away. And so I thank you, Adam, for keeping this going, giving it one more round on the guitar.
That's the goal. Thank you, David. Hey, folks, thanks for joining us for this episode. I know it might have been a long wait. It's a busy summer, a busy time for me. I would have liked to have gotten this out a few weeks ago, but it turned out that wasn't possible. So here we are, and I'm releasing it on Labor Day 2024, just as a unique celebration of Pete Seeger. In terms of academic knowledge, David Dunaway is a great resource. Naturally, his book on Seeger, How Can I Keep From Singing, is a significant source for me for this show. But as I learned in preparing for this conversation and then in actually talking to David, there is clearly a plethora of information at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress, which anyone can access. And if you want to learn more, feel free to investigate. As we learned, some of the stuff is physical, but much of it is electronic. And it's just a great collection that David has put together for the world to use. Additionally, David's radio series from the 2000s is also great and covers the big pieces of Seeger's life. I think I go into a little bit more specificity with my show than he does with that, but he has a lot of great interviews with other people. So you can learn more about that at his website at davidkdunaway.com or at his website rememberingpeteseeger.org, where people can share their memories of Pete and read what others have to say in memoriam. In any event, I really enjoyed this conversation. I think it adds some authenticity to what gets talked about on the show, and it was great to be able to host someone who worked closely with Pete in archiving all this history. And I certainly hope to do other interviews like this with other authors and musicians as well that knew and worked with Pete. So coming up for the podcast this fall, we'll begin season 2 next month of the show, and we'll jump right into Pete's deeper engagements with civil rights in 1963, and then cover his world trip or world tour, whatever you may call it, that he makes from 1963 into 1964. So those are exciting topics, things we don't know a ton about in their entirety. I hope you enjoy and look forward to those episodes. So I'll see you all next time.